All right. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to another special new edition of Haze Reviews, which I'm tentatively calling Haze Interviews. So for viewers of the channel, you know what I tend to do is live streams, and we get into the books and we do some research and reading. Now I'm branching out and I'm talking to authors of books about their books. And so today we've got the first instantiation of this new project, and I'm incredibly grateful, happy, delighted, honored, and overjoyed to be welcoming James Corbett to the show to discuss his new book. James, how are you doing today?
I'm doing excellent. Thank you for having me on.
Well, thank you. Thank you. So I don't think you need much of an introduction for my audience, at least. People will be aware that my sort of journey into creating content was heavily influenced by you and a conversation you have with Richard Grove back on the Grand Theft World podcast, episode 4, I think, in which I actually followed you to his podcast. And that was my first introduction to Richard, to Grand Theft World, and to a whole slew of books that you and he were talking about. And I just thought, these books exist. How did I not know about this stuff? All these aspects of history that I had never heard anyone talk about before. So that kicked off for me a bit of an obsession with obtaining these books and building up my physical library because of the censorship we were going through back then. I thought, well, if the online space is going to get memory hold, you know, at least I got these books that I can point to and read and research, continuing my learning. And so I started the YouTube channel off the back of that, and I started thinking about talking to authors. And then I was absolutely delighted to find that you had brought a book out very recently. And so I reached out and you agreed to come on to talk. So that's kind of the background of why we're here today. Before we get into your new book and the contents and all that kind of thing, I wanted to get your sort of view on reading and books in general. So I know that you have an English literature degree, which I also have, and you also have a master's, which I do not have. But you clearly got your start in reading the written word and in books. And so, yeah, just a little bit about the importance of books and how they played a role in bringing you to where you are today.
Yes. What an incredible story that you have there. And it's one of the most gratifying pieces of feedback that I can ever get, that some conversation of mine helped spur someone into their journey going down not just the rabbit hole, but the literary rabbit hole. That's a particularly interesting one and near and dear to my heart, because I am an inveterate reader, have been for most of my life. Sadly, alas and alack, given what I do for a living, unfortunately, now I do a lot of reading online, and not enough as in the physical book variety, although I do that as well, but I would prefer to spend my time buried in books, but oh well, I have devices as well. But yes, reading has been an important part of my journey throughout my life, and I have encountered a number of people along the way who have inspired me in that. I mentioned, for example, in the acknowledgements of my book, Aretha Van Herk, who was my creative writing professor at the University of Calgary. She also was an inveterate reader, reading one or two books a day, which, whoa, how can that be done? But evidently, she does it. And she was the one, for example, who pointed me in the direction of Faulkner, who I never considered. I thought, oh, I probably wouldn't enjoy him. And then he ended up becoming one of my favorite authors. So, but also, there was a fellow student in one of my classes, and I was inspired by her because every time I saw her each week, she had a different book and she was always, always reading. And I thought, hey, I should do that. So I started reading more as a result of that. And I've always liked the word. The written word has always, I don't know, everyone has their thing. I guess mine is literary works of fiction up until the point at which I started going down the conspiratorial rabbit hole online. And then it became about nonfiction. And I would say over the past couple of decades, I have read an awful lot of nonfiction and not nearly enough fiction. So that is something that I will have to correct. But yes, the written word has always appealed to me. It's what I'm interested in. It's sort of the way that I've always envisioned myself since I was 10 years old. I wanted to be a writer. And so I've thought about this the vast majority of my life. And here we are, after all of that, and after 15 years of work, I have a book of essays, which I have had multiple people tell me they read in one day. So 15 years of work in one day. Oh, well.
That's fantastic. And I could totally appreciate and understand why that is. I sat down, I did 70 pages in my first sitting, and I immediately sent you an email to say, this is so good. I want to talk to you about it. Please come on and let's do an interview. Because I just knew 70 pages in, I was like, this is something special. This is a really fantastic resource. And we're very blessed and lucky that you did that 15 years of work. But it's really a lifetime of work, isn't it? Because all the stuff you had to go through before that, the traveling, living abroad, studying, moving around, shaping your character, really all fed into this. And in my opinion, it is a masterful achievement. So let's introduce the book and let's talk about it a little bit. So this is James Corbett's book. I've got a copy right here. And I know that there's been a little bit of confusion about the title and how it's pronounced. So I'm going to set the record straight right now. This is James's book. It is Reportage. Okay. So everyone's got that. This
it's
is Reportage.
Reportage, but it's pronounced Throat Wobble a Mangrove.
I actually learned, because when I saw it, I did the same thing as Jimmy Dore. I said, oh, it's reportage. That's an interesting word. I did exactly the same thing as he did. But that is, you know, the correct pronunciation of that word is one of the many, many, many things that I learned while reading this book. It's a tour de force. It's so well referenced, so well researched. It's so accessible. You know, I'm actually thinking I could buy this for anybody in my family, regardless of their inclinations with like alternative media or not. You know, it is so accessible, and I think that's the first thing I wanted to say. So 15 years in the making, what was that like for you, that whole process? Was it like a thorn in your mind, I got to get this book out and bring it into the world? Was it, that sounds like a long birthing process with lots of labor pangs. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Right. Yes. No, it's difficult to even explain it, because when you say 15 years of work, people are probably thinking I'm sitting there at the writing desk every single day for 15 years nonstop. Of course, it wasn't like that. But I did have the original conception for this book, including the original conception for at least a few of the essays that ended up in the final book, were started in 2009. And what an incredibly long and laborious process it was. But in some ways, that's to the good. I really do think that you can see some of the development of some of my ideas through these essays, because over the course of 15 years, obviously, I learned a lot and I shifted my position and my understanding on many different things. And I think some of that is retained in here. You see some of the stages of my development, and I wanted that to be part of it. And one of the things that I certainly didn't set out to do this, but I'm glad that it has taken 15 years to do this, if only because some of the references that have remained in some of these essays are relatively obscure. Things that, yes, of course, me back in 2010, 11, 12, I was researching, I had all of these references to these particular things that were passing through the news wires at those times. Fast forward to 2025, those are the sorts of things that absolutely would have been forgotten, even by myself. If I was sitting down to write some of these essays today, I wouldn't think to remember, oh yeah, that article from 2004 that I dug up in 2011, let's put that in there. No, of course not. So it actually does represent, I think, this window of time that otherwise it would not have if I'd written it all at once.
No, that's great. So it's like the idea of a book as a time capsule. I often talk about this. It's we're communicating. It's like time travel, right? You read these books and they're written in the past, and the authors might have left this mortal coil, and we're communicating with their mind, which was shaped by a context and a time that is now gone. And with the rapid change and influx of news and things happening and social media and the internet age, with the bombardment of information that we live in, to bring this physical artifact into existence that is a sort of snapshot of that 15 years, it's wonderful that you did that.
Can I just add on as a tag to that, because that actually relates to something I was just talking to my editor about. I just wrote an essay on A Battle for Your Brain is already underway. And in that article, I reference an article that I read that was published last year, but I talked about that article in the context of this author explains da 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 da. And my editor called me out on that. Well, you said it's from last year, but you said explains. It should be explained. And I thought, no. Because when I talk about an idea that is in a essay or in an article or in a book, when you are reading it, that idea is there in the now. It is present tense. So Shakespeare warns of the problems of family rivalry in Romeo and Juliet. Yes, of course, he wrote it Well, actually, whoever wrote Shakespeare wrote it hundreds and hundreds of years ago. But that idea is alive now. When we open the book, it is alive on the page and we are reading it. We are bringing it back into existence. So you're right. It is a time capsule, but it's one that persists into future eras. And throughout human history, or at least throughout written, recorded human history, ideas that have been transmitted that way have survived, or at least I'd like to think that the ideas that survive, that pass through the filter of time itself, are the ones that, at the very least, that do shape human thought and understanding. And we are standing on the shoulders of the giants of all of these writers that have come from the past. And so to have my tiny little contribution to that great cultural discourse that's been taking place for thousands of years, well, it was important for me to do that.
Fantastic. Yeah. And you'd really do capture some important ideas and messages in here as well. Specifically, I'm thinking towards the end of the book, the final few essays, where the book kind of climaxes with a very important message that I think is in danger of being sort of stamped out or stomped on or erased from human consciousness. It's great that you've encapsulated that in there. So I'll read, maybe get to one of those a little bit later. There's a couple of bits I wanted to get your view on, though, and your explanation. So one of the concepts in the book is something that you call up-down politics. I was wondering if you could sort of encapsulate this and give us a little, in a nutshell, explanation of what that is, because people are familiar with left politics and right politics and the blue team and the red team, but what's up-down politics? How are we? You've changed the dimensions on us, and it's a bit disorienting.
Right, as it probably should be, I guess, for people who have been raised, as I think we all have been, in the left-right political paradigm. It is some, we have been taught our entire lives that there is precisely one dimension to politics. It is a left-right line. It goes from the left wing to the right wing, and there is center. But that is all, the entire political universe that has been presented to us. And from that perspective, from that one-dimensional perspective, it's, of course, very easy. If I'm here on the right, then that person who disagrees with me is on the left. If I'm here on the left, the person who disagrees with me is right. It's very easy to categorize things and to see the world. But it's like putting on some sort of polarizing filter or sunglasses. You're not getting certain wavelengths of light. You're not understanding the full dimensions of the world that you're operating in. So that when you encounter something that doesn't quite fit to that left-right spectrum, it's very disorienting and confusing. I mean, the Rockefeller family, they're Republicans, I guess, but what does that mean? But they're for global government? What is happening here? So obviously, we're only looking at this one dimension. There's clearly more to the political universe than that one-dimensional line. And so getting people to understand and to think that, okay, so what else does exist? And there are many charts and things that people have done with the top left and top right and bottom left, bottom right, and which part of the axis are you on? But unfortunately, that part of political orientation has not really filtered down to the public consciousness. So this is my humble attempt to try to get people to see, in addition, yes, okay, there is a left and right, but there is also an up and down. And when you exclude the up and down completely and only talk about the left and right, then the up and down becomes absolutely the most important part of the political paradigm, the political universe, because it's the excluded part. And that excluded part is authoritarian versus libertarian. People who believe in centralizing power into fewer and fewer hands with greater and greater authority versus people who want decentralization of power down, ultimately, at the far bottom, to the individual. And if we neglect that debate, then we don't understand that, yes, you can have authoritarians on the left arguing with authoritarians on the right, but the political world keeps moving in this authoritarian direction. What is happening? Why is this happening? It's because you are not seeing the up and down part of the political spectrum.
Brilliant. Yeah, I love it. Great explanation. Another, when I was reading that essay as well, I was thinking of another way to frame it could be the morists and the lessists. And there's some people who want more government control and intervention and regulation and laws and policy, and other people who want less of that, please. Less of the centralization of control in fewer hands in further and further away places. So that's another way to look at it too, is the morists and the lessists. So one of the things I really wanted to ask you about as well was in the essay, How to Enjoy Your Servitude. And on page 185, if I can read a quote, would that be all right?
Please do.
So page 185, you've written, beyond systems of control that rely on brute force and naked aggression, there exists what Huxley describes as an array of non-terroristic techniques for inducing consent and inducing people to love their servitude. And my audience are pretty familiar with Huxley. We've read a few of his books. I've discussed them with Melissa of CuttingThroughTheMatrix.com. And his book, Brave New World Revisited, is an eye-opener, let's say, if people aren't familiar with the contents of that. But you continue. Such non-terroristic control tactics include the use of psychopharmaceuticals and TV screen flicker rates and social media algorithms to induce voluntary consent in targeted individuals. So the bit I wanted to focus in on here is TV screen flicker rates. So I know that you've done a four-part, I think, course on the history of media and the forms it's taken. But this bit stood out to me because I'm seeing the screen and screen addiction as one of the key problems that we're facing in the modern world. It's even beyond what's on the screen. It's just the fact that so many of us are spending so many of our precious seconds, minutes, and hours staring at screens and not each other's faces or not a sunset or a beautiful plant in the garden or whatever it may be, actual reality, in other words. So how has screens and flicker rates, how's this been used sort of against people?
An excellent question. And there are, yes, I have got resources to back me up on this. Unfortunately, I'm going to have to get the screen out to look at them because I do not have a photographic memory. But I did talk about this in the Media Matrix and specifically in my three-part online media course, The History of the Mass Media, in which I talked about the research that has been done that on such things as television's screen flicker rates. And I'm not going to have the exact, actually, I do have the exact reference off the top of my head. The research conducted by Herbert Krugman in 1969, he would go on to become a public opinion research manager at General Electric in the 1970s. But in 69, he was busy hooking electrodes up to the back of test subjects' heads and wiring them to a Grass Model 7 polygraph, which in turn interfaced with a Honeywell 7600 computer and a Cat 400B computer. And he turned on the TV and began monitoring the brain waves of his subjects. And he found through repeated testing that, quote, within about 30 seconds, the brain waves switched from predominantly beta waves, indicating alert and conscious attention, to predominantly alpha waves, indicating an unfocused, receptive lack of attention, the state of aimless fantasy and daydreaming below the threshold of consciousness. So he found, and this has been repeated by multiple experiments, I've talked about this and documented it, but yes, people tend to go into a trance-like state when they are watching television specifically, was what this research was about. And it's not exactly sleep. It's not exactly wakefulness. It's more like that sort of in-between state when you're just sort of zoning out. And as I say, I think this is particularly interesting given the age in which we're living, in which people do spend more time in front of screens than they do in front of human beings. What is this phenomenon doing to us? Now, is this also true of computer screens and the way that computer screens refresh may be different than the way that television screens refresh? So I do not know about the latest research related to that, but I do know about this research from the 1960s, and I do know from my own personal experience. I remember this as a child looking during a particularly interesting television show, looking around at the room at my family members and watching them watch the TV is almost sort of a horror movie experience in and of itself, because you see people who are zombified and who are clearly reacting emotionally or with facial expressions to things that aren't really happening. These are things on a screen. This is not happening in the real world, but people are so invested in them that they become this sort of zombified state. I think if you have not had that experience, you should watch someone watching TV at some point. And I think we can all understand that there is something to this, that the flicker rates and whatever else does put people into a type of hypnotic trance in which they are highly suggestible. And that is the important part of this, because television is not speaking to your conscious mind. It is speaking to your subconscious mind. And that whatever filter you might have with your rational mind, capable of thinking and cogitating about things before you react to them, that filter is down when you are in this trance-like state. And that should be worrying to all of us, again, considering how much time we're all spending in front of screens these days.
Well said. And I wanted to mention this book as well. The Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television by Jerry Mander is an excellent book written in the 70s. And you're talking about research from the 60s. In there, he talks about research carried out in the 60s where they were studying different frequencies of light, the effects on the cells in our body. And he says that they figured out which frequencies of light can turn cells cancerous. And that was in another book called, I think, Light and Health, a little paperback by a guy called Jonathan Ott, hundreds and hundreds of dollars if you want to buy that now. So what is amazing to me is how much has been known and sort of not taught to us through our schooling systems and is not coming at us through the television. Obviously, there's not going to be a lot of information coming at us through the TV telling us, hey, what you're doing right now is very dangerous and risky. And so that's really mind-blowing. But yeah, thanks for that. I really appreciate your thoughts on the television flickering. So another concept I wanted to draw out and get you to please explain is the one of spontaneous order. This is something that I think there's a whole essay dedicated to this. I think it's an introduction, a brief introduction to spontaneous order. What is that? What role does this concept or idea or reality play in moving forward when we are living through the interesting times that we are living through?
Yes, thank you. Good question. Well, I suppose I would say that a lot of these essays really are trying to break through the sort of conditioning that people have been under. For example, the idea of the left-right. Well, how about up-down? In this case, the idea of order, which I think we all understand intuitively in a certain sense, because the only way we ever hear of that word or think about it is generally in the sense of a top-down imposed order by some central authority. That is the only type of order that I think we are ever asked to actually cogitate on, certainly in our cultural conversations or in our education system, etc. As evidence of which, I would posit, for example, if you say the word order, if you're doing some sort of word association game, a lot of people would probably say law and order. The idea there not being, of course, common law derived from a pattern of practice of adjudication over a period of generations that arrive at a sort of communal sense of what law may be. No, law as in, I wrote down this thing on a piece of paper and I have a special hat on my head, therefore you are bound to it. That form of law and order, I think, is what people tend to think, to the point where it has now become so non-intuitive that it might actually be unthinkable for people that you could have any other sort of order. How could an order possibly arise unless there is a leader, a ruler, somebody who writes down some law and gives it to people? Then order can take place. However, this is not true, and this has been understood for thousands of years. So, for example, I talk about Lao Tzu in the book, and the Scottish Enlightenment thinkers and others who have talked about this concept over the course of centuries. But the idea is, no, order does not have to arrive top down from a centralized figure who is imposing law upon the people. It can arise bottom up. And it's hard, again, for people to understand that, which is strange to me because it is all around us in all sorts of, all manner of things that we have that were not decided on by some ruling council of fill in the blank. For example, a simple example that people would be able to relate to these days, there is no ruling council of every programmer must use this programming language in this way in order to make their computer. No, but people decide it would be a lot better if our computer programs could talk to each other and operate on some shared platform. So let's create some platform that will be able to interpret this code and we'll all contribute code in this way so that the computers will be able to read it. Again, there's no centralized decision law of the universe that it has to be this way. People come together because they want to cooperate. And that really is, I think, something that has been squelched out of our cultural conversation. The idea of the marketplace as a place where people, to come together to bring their own individual talents, skills, resources, things that they have to offer to the community so that the community can then, okay, I need that. I would like your service. I would like some of that. And they will exchange what they have. And everyone benefits from those voluntary exchanges. And from that chaos, oh my God, who is ruling over this process and telling everyone, now you have to be a blacksmith. And you have to be a milkman. And you have to do this. You have to do that. No one is telling every single person in society what to do. And yet somehow society coheres. How could this possibly be? It is because so much of our lives is lived in that sort of spontaneous order that, like the fish swimming in the water, we have no idea what water is. We can't even see it. Water? You're some kind of conspiracy theorist talking about water. No. I don't know what you're talking about. So it's maddening from a certain perspective to just try to get people to see something that's right in front of their face. But sometimes that can be the hardest thing to do. And to the extent that I even get people to think about these things, I would consider that a win.
Absolutely. And an example that I'll throw in is I used to live in Vietnam, in Hanoi specifically. And I know you're out in that part of the world. I don't know if you've ever visited, but it's a wonderful mm-hmm. city. It's crazy. It's very intense. And back when I was living there, and it's probably still the same to this day, although they might be doing something about it now, but the roads were so chaotic. Everyone's driving around on their little bikes. They're carrying pig carcasses. They're carrying all their children and their aunties and their brothers and sisters' children and grandparents on one bike. They've got huge pieces of furniture and they're going driving along. And you watch the tourists and they stand at the edge of the street and they're just like looking left and right and thinking, I'm going to die because it's just nonstop and everyone's weaving in and out. And you can drive on any side of the road you want. Traffic lights, there are some traffic lights, but people do obey them, but they're not as prevalent as some Western countries. And yet, if you look on the other side of the street and set off walking and maintain your pace and don't panic, everything will flow around you. All the drivers, it's kind of like a collective intelligence almost. And I used to love riding my bike around there because I felt like it was a sort of Zen meditation, because you had to be in the moment and aware and paying attention and looking around you and what's behind you and listening. And you couldn't be thinking and planning and stressing and getting tense about it, because then you'd cause an accident. And if you did something, you hit someone else and there'd be a big knock-on effect. So that's just an example of
how, again, like Chinese philosophy, the idea of instead of trying to redirect the water, no, let the water flow and find its way. And it will be a lot easier if you go with that. And again, it's interesting. Yes, it does come to back to core concepts like these. And I do in the book talk, for example, about the shared space concept by Hans Mondermann, the Dutch traffic designer. And the idea of, again, completely counterintuitive, at least to most Western minds, I would say, the idea of getting rid of road signs, road markings, traffic lights, other forms of regulation on the street actually makes the streets safer. And that, again, blows people's minds. They cannot believe it until you start showing them specific examples. Look at Portishead, and they removed all the traffic lights, and actually traffic flowed faster, and there were less accidents, and they were just doing it as a trial, but they decided to keep it because it was actually a better way of directing traffic. By not directing traffic. Again, it blows people's minds to the point where they will actually fight it. You show them an example in which it works and they will tell you why it doesn't work, which is just such a strange thing. Of course, it does point to it inwardly. I think certain people have a desire for that concept of law and order being gaveled down by the authority figure. And I really do think it is a state of, well, immaturity, in a sense, for example, that we envision society or culture generally as a family unit, and there are as mother and father as in daddy government and mommy government. Daddy government will come and beat the bad guys and put them in jail, and mommy government will wipe your nose and take care of you cradle to grave. And I think people are stuck in that sense of political adolescence, not willing to leave the home, not willing to get out, until we collectively leave the home and decide that we ourselves are adults capable of acting for ourselves. Well, it's a very different mindset. And unfortunately, I think there are a lot of people who are not ready to take that mental step yet. But I'm just encouraging them to at least look at the possibility, because, hey, it exists.
Yeah, I would say get a bike and go drive around Hanoi and be amazed at the magic of spontaneous order. It is a real thing. It is possible. It can be experienced. So fantastic. Yeah. And to your point about this state of adolescence, people want to, they don't want responsibility for their behaviors in a lot of cases. And it's kind of, I want to do this thing, but I don't want to, I want somebody else to sort out the mess that it creates. And so, yeah, stepping into adulthood, responsible decision making, responsibility for ourselves and our loved ones and the people around us. I think it's a great thing to remind people of. So I appreciate you mentioning that in the book as well. And that brings me and connects nicely to another thing I wanted to talk to you about, which is environmentalism. So you talk about this in the book. There's an amazing essay on who controls environmentalism, I think is the title. And we're seeing this now manifest in a lot of the governments. They're telling you, wash your yogurt cartons and put this thing in that bin over there and pay this tax for driving that car in that place. So the rules are coming out. The top-down control is coming out. But this isn't for our benefit. And there is actually a connection here with a movement which leaves a sour taste in everybody's mouth, which is eugenics. And you did I learned a lot from this particular essay. Could you tell us a little bit about the connection between environmentalism and eugenics and what your research has sort of uncovered there?
Yes, it is a fascinating connection and one that is not, it's not that it isn't admitted, it's just that it isn't talked about very much. So for example, you'll see I believe it was the New Yorker writing about Madison Grant and his connection to, well, everyone knows him of the passing of the Great Race and the other kind of racist literature that very much appealed to Hitler, for example, calling Grant's work his Bible back when he read it. But people today don't remember Madison Grant as the great conservationist. And he was one of the founders of conservationism in America. And some of his buddies, like, for example, I believe it was Teddy Roosevelt, who was also a great eugenicist, was also known for his conservationist leanings. And when you start to look at it, a lot of these great conservationists from the past had this connection. They believed in, for example, the purity of the race and eugenics and only the best should breed with the best, which is weirdly kind of tied in with their conservationist ethics, because as has been pointed out by people, for example, in Madison Grant's, I believe, obituary, it did point out that he did care about the noble elk and the moose and these, you know, noble creatures, but couldn't care less about the sort of lower level creatures, the, you know, birds and ants and whatever. Who cares? I only care about these noble species. And in a way, that is reflective of that mindset. There are noble people and they deserve the riches and splendor of this vast planet, which will be theirs for the taking without all these useless eaters walking around. We got to get rid of them. And then we can enjoy the noble elk in his, you know, forest, etc. And there are so many connections in that regard that shows the sort of mentality. There is a like-minded mentality. For example, the aforementioned Rockefeller family became great conservationists who bought, the Rockefellers had vast swaths of land that they wanted to preserve. CNN, Ted Turner, of course, a big environmentalist, has huge swaths of property on which he has a very large family, many children, while he goes around lecturing other people about the dangers of having too many children, because we don't want too many of you kind spreading your ugly protoplasm around, or whatever the eugenicists of our day and age call it. So there is this historical connection. And then when you start to follow the environmental movement as it developed, you start to see the actual organizations that were literally founded by these eugenicists and their ilk. For example, Julian Huxley being involved in the formation of the World Wildlife Federation. Also, of course, one of the founding director of UNESCO, which from its very founding document was talking about eugenics and making it politically viable again after that whole Nazi thing, whatever. Okay, that was, you know, we don't want to talk about that, but eugenics needs to be made politically viable again and UNESCO will work on it. Weirdly enough, I never heard about that when I was taught about UNESCO as a youngster in the Canadian public school system. I wonder why they leave out that part of the history, but there are many connections of that sort. And it isn't to say, of course, that environmentalism itself is necessarily eugenicist, or that anyone who is an environmentalist is some sort of evil person that needs to be shunned. Of course not. But I think it's because it is such an inherently appealing idea. No one wants to leave the earth in tatters. No one wants to plunder all of its resources and make the earth uninhabitable. Of course not. But that unfortunately, that urge has been taken over by people with a very specific and very different agenda. And so that manifests in, well, we need to steward over the resources and wealth of the earth on your behalf, for Mother Earth's sake, of course. And that's how we arrive at the doorstep of this $100 trillion green transition that's going to be stewarded over by GFANs and these other international bodies presided over by the UN and meted out by these natural asset corporations that they're going to make up and trade stocks in and all of this. Don't worry, it's all for your own good. We're just going to monopolize the resources of the planet and give you less and less. You'll be eating your bug burgers in your little EnviroPod in your 15-minute city, and we'll tell you when and if you can leave your home, and you will pat yourself on the back for doing all of that because you are saving Mother Earth while you're doing it. And that is the real tragedy here. Yes, there are real environmental problems, but generally speaking, the real environmental problems are brushed under the rug. The GMO monstrosities that are increasingly populating the earth and other such things, whereas the things that are focused on, oh, it's carbon dioxide, actually tend to be the actual foodstuff of life itself on this planet. And I don't think that's coincidental.
Beautifully said. I appreciated that answer. So coherent, and you can tell that you have been thinking about and studying this stuff a lot. You draw together so many different aspects, Rockefellers, UNESCO, the Huxleys, all of it. But you did mention something I wanted to talk about, which is the GMO. Your essay on GMO is the most referenced one in the collection with 109 footnotes. And this is a real bombshell for people who are quite blasé or unaware, let's say, of the prevalence of these products. So could you tell us a little bit about that research? I think the essay is GMO Doomsday. What is going on in this area that makes you have to marshal the most amount of evidence in the entire book to support it?
Yes, it's a good question because it is such a very large topic, and it was written in the context. This was primarily, at least the first drafts of this, was written primarily before the scamdemic that we just lived through that I think has done something to at least alert certain sections of the public to the idea that scientists aren't floating on clouds, all-knowing creatures that could never possibly either make a mistake or, heaven forfend, actually be persuaded to fudge data or evidence in a certain direction for political purposes. How could that ever happen? I think people are starting to see this, but this was written primarily before that and in an age where, interestingly enough, when I started the Corbett Report in 2007, I expected there would be a lot of pushback against crazy ideas like 9/11 truth, etc. But no, actually, the most pushback I think I've ever received, not so much these days, but I have received over the years, has been pushback against, you don't believe the scientists, global warming must be true. How can you possibly? So I've had that type of feedback a lot. So I definitely did want to do my homework, really be able to reference and understand this topic. And I'm glad you noticed that at the very least. There was a lot of research that went into that essay. However, I was just recently on an edition of New World Next Week with James Evan Pilato of MeteorMonarchy.com. We were talking about a story regarding glyphosate and some of the moves that are being made to essentially remove liability for the glyphosate manufacturers for their cancer-causing products. And I was talking about the research that, for example, I cite in that essay about the dangers of glyphosate. And interestingly enough, I got one comment from a subscriber. So it wasn't just some sort of random person. It was somebody who subscribes to my work who apparently went out and asked ChatGPT or whatever their AI of choice was, well, is there any good research showing that glyphosate is dangerous? And apparently the AI said something to the effect of, no, not really. It's safe as mother's milk. And this person thought, oh, well, okay, then I don't believe James's essay. And he claimed that I've cited one research paper on glyphosate or something like that. Anyway, glyphosate was not the main point of the essay, but even so, I did have several different resources that themselves link to several more resources. And there's a lot more to be said about it. But there is definitely a larger agenda towards the genetic modification of not only our food supply, but increasingly the world in general. And I think that at the very least, I gesture towards the fact that why do they have this GMO doomsday seed vault in the Arctic that they've cut out of the permafrost in the rocks, buried a kilometer deep into a mountain in order to preserve the world's natural genetic heritage? What kind of disaster are they preparing for exactly that we will need that sort of safekeeping for whatever may be coming? And at the very least, again, I hope that gets people at least thinking along the lines of the type of open air experimentation with the genome of the planet itself that is being run right now. And I think a lot of people are taking that in a rather blasé fashion. And I don't think they should be.
Well, yeah, brilliant. And that actually brings me to another thing I wanted to ask you about. Conscious of time, we've got a little bit longer, but is the AI question. So you mentioned this listener who fact-checked you with some sort of large language model and came back and said, poo-poo on you, James Corbett. Grok tells me that you're making things up. What do you think about this era we're now living in? There's the dead internet theory. There's all this AI content. They're making podcasts with fake AI voices and presenters, which are so uncanny and eerie to listen to that I can't stand them, to be honest. But me and you, I think we're sort of, we're a bit more analog than that, where we like to read, look at the books, the sources, the research. What does this era mean for people like us who like to get the books and the documents and do the footnotes and references and that sort of thing?
You know, honestly, the things that really keep me up at night, the things that really disturb me are not so much the things that they, them, those are doing to us, because I believe that as long as the human spirit exists, it will always fight against tyranny and oppression. And it may, there may be dark periods in which that does not look so hopeful, but that will eventually, tyrants will be overthrown and the human spirit will once again emerge, unless and until we essentially give up our human spirit. And that is the kind of thing. It's not from them doing things to us. It is what we do or choose not to do. And the people who are increasingly giving away their cognitive sovereignty to large language models, I have received so many emails of late from people who are genuinely excited because they got ChatGPT or Perplexity or Grok or whoever to say something that they already believed. It's like, oh, it said the truth about this thing. Maybe it is a truth thing after all. And they get so excited about that, that it's perplexing. But perhaps even more disturbing than that are the people who now use AI as their research tool. As in, not so much that they are just trying to find things that they can then research and go further into. No, they're asking the AI Oracle a question. It gives them an answer. And maybe there's some references there in the answer, but they don't bother to check it because there's the answer. And this is exactly, precisely what Eric Schmidt, former Google CEO, or Alphabet CEO, was talking about several years ago when at a conference, he said, well, you know how you type a question into Google and there's 8 million results. Well, that's a bug. That's not a feature. No. In the future, you will type something in and it will give you precisely one answer. And that will be the answer that you need because it will know. In fact, you won't even have to ask the question because it will already know what information you need and it'll just provide it to you. And that is what we are heading into. And for people who do not understand why, how could it possibly be that that might not be the best way to organize our society, they should watch The Selfish Ledger, which was this leaked Google internal Google video that came out several years ago, which talks about not just how to shape a particular person or even a society, but really humanity itself by leading people along through an algorithmic chain of making this decision and making this choice and feeding this person this information so that they come to this decision, talking about the idea, well, in the near future, the AI or whatever systems will be able to design entire products that they decide will appeal to you and B will make you do this particular thing that it wants you to do so that they can start engineering your life. And then the Google engineers ask, well, what are we really? We're just a collection of experiences and our decisions are motivated by our previous experiences. So if we can shape and tailor people's experiences and what information they're receiving, we control your entire life. We control who you are fundamentally. This is what it's going to. Who are we? Are we just passive receptacles for the AI oracle that's just going to feed us information? Or are we human beings capable of thinking for ourselves and coming to our own conclusions based on information that we are actively seeking out? Or are we content to just be passive receptacles of a feed of information that's coming at us through some algorithmic process that we don't even understand, or in some cases don't even understand that it's happening at all? That to me is what really scares me. And we, again, it comes down to our choices and what we do.
Yeah, well said. I agree with you 100%. And a side note as well, I was reading this book, The Shallows, Nicholas Carr, and he talks about one of the very earliest chat bots that was coded back in the 60s, and it was named Eliza, and the name was taken from a play written by George Bernard Shaw, Fabian Socialist, and another rabbit, infamous eugenicist, right? So these things connect. The way humans interface with these sorts of technology has been studied for a long time. So final thing now, we're going to wrap this up here. One of the things you mentioned right at the end of the book, and I might read this quote, if that's all right with you, because it really stood out to me, and I thought, this is it. This is the message that I really resonate with and agree with. So it's just a paragraph. It's on page 300. You wrote, "Our world does not require a top-down order imposed by elite members of an exclusive superclass who, by virtue of some magical political ritual, are able to impose their will on the common man without his consent. On the contrary, a thriving society requires the spontaneous order that develops when everyone is free to form voluntary relationships based on mutual consent." And then you followed that up with, in the next essay, with something here about, "I am penning this piece with the hope of reinstilling my readers with a sense of wonder and a sense of humility, feelings that seem to have been sucked out of this age of know-it-alls who have seen everything and are surprised by nothing. Contrary to what cynics believe, the universe is far more wondrous than we could ever imagine." And I wanted to make sure I got that on the record and just to hear your sort of final thoughts. I think what you just said about retaining our human spirit and our very humanity, that's what's under attack here. So being, looking at the wondrousness of reality, being creative, having a musical output. I know you got your guitars there. I got mine over here. Just doing things every day to bolster and express that human spirit is so important. Would you agree? And if you got anything else to add?
Yes. Obviously, I think this is absolutely central to what we are really facing, because what we are really facing is not a group of people per se. It is an ideology. It's the idea of essentially the vision of the future of a race of superiors ruling over some slave-like race, the Eloys and the Morlocks, right? Yes, I think that is the vision of the technocratic future that the they, them, those would like to impose on us. And unfortunately, a lot of people adapt or adopt that mentality without even realizing they have adopted the master's mentality, and they're the slave, and they're almost happy with that position. And that is the travesty. So how do we rekindle that human spirit? And that's increasingly difficult to do as we in a sense, maybe this is a part of actually growing up. So I talk about the adolescence that we are in as children in this family society, the family vision of government, and the fact that we need to grow up. Well, as you start to grow up and as you enter your teenage years and become a know-it-all and become cynical and ironic and, oh, what do my parents know anyway, and adapt nihilistic philosophies, etc., maybe that is the era in which we are stepping into, because certainly for decades now, irony was one of the defining features of Generation X, for example, and ironic takes and stances on everything. You never put your true feelings out. It's always this level of sarcasm and irony and always hiding behind veils. And that's what it means to be cool and sophisticated, is to never actually. So it's easy to cross your arms at a certain point after having learnt a lot of this information, to cross your arms, become cynical, and then just become corrosive and just exist to essentially spit acid on anything or anyone that is out there and somehow feel that you are accomplishing something with that. And that is, well, if that is the adolescent phase, I certainly hope we can grow out of that and achieve true adulthood, which is to, yes, not be naive like children, but not to be cynical, corrosive like adolescents. No, to achieve that point at which we realize, no, we are here. And we can either foster and create and bring about new, beautiful things into this world, a family or whatever else, be creative, or we can sit on the sidelines, never do anything, poo-poo everything, and just die alone and unhappy. And I don't know about you, but I know which path sounds like a more fulfilling life to me. And this is why it's always difficult for me to answer the question that I do get from time to time. I do get this question quite frequently. James, how do you maintain any sort of positivity, knowing what you know and doing this kind of research and looking at these dark subjects? Well, in a sense, that's everything that I am motivated by is my desire to inspire and to bring about good things in this world, because I love this world and I love my family and I love life. And if you don't feel that, and if you don't have that at your core, I'm afraid probably what you're going to bring into this world is not good and wonderful. So I don't know how to instill that in people other than to say the way that I see the world and what it is I am fighting for, not who I'm fighting against. That is not the operative part of it. No, what do I want? What am I fighting for? What am I moving towards? Without that goal, then what is the point of any of this?
James, amazing. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming on to talk to me and the audience. James Corbett, reportage. You heard it here first. Well, no, it's not here first, but you heard the correct pronunciation here first. Thank you again. It's been wonderful to spend this time with you. All the best for your future endeavors, and hopefully we can talk again at some point.
Absolutely. I appreciate it. Thank you for having me on.